Well, South Africa is in the global news right now, and there's a lot of misinformation, disinformation, agenda-driven nonsense. We've been trying to get to the facts, and we did it recently when examining or interrogating some information that had gone into the public domain and was repeated time and again that 70% of South African land is owned by whites. Well, we know now that that's absolute nonsense. The number is around 20%, and that comes from the data that actually unpacks it. But when you selectively pull things, you can make the data to say anything you like. Another thing that the rest of the world believes is that apartheid, or race-based laws, perhaps we should put it, ended with apartheid. Well, that isn't actually the case, as Martin van Staden will be explaining. He compiles for the Institute for Race Relations an index on the laws in South Africa that are race-related. And he'll be giving us some insights here on the way that they've actually been growing rather than falling. Martin, good to be with you. It's interesting that you're with the Free Market Foundation, where you're the head of policy, but you still do this work for your former organization, for the Institute for Race Relations. I suppose it tells us that there's friendly relationships between the two NGOs.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, the IRR and the FMF are both classically liberal, or you could say libertarian, market liberal organizations. We ultimately believe that freedom is the best way to solve South Africa's problems. We all believe in property rights, and certainly we're united by our shared commitment to non-racialism, which is just another manifestation of kind of liberal individualism. That is to say that you really shouldn't use the circumstances of someone's birth, certainly not a biological circumstance of someone's birth, to determine what they may and may not do. So there is definitely a shared commitment to that. So there is no conflict of interest.
It was interesting reading through the information that you've published that race-based laws in South Africa go back a long, long way. Now, without boring everybody with a long history lesson, can you just explain to us how long we've had them and why they didn't all disappear in 1994 when most of us here and abroad thought they would?
Yeah, so I mean, South African race law goes back hundreds of years, but the index of race law starts in 1910, which is in May of that year, South Africa's parliament, as it exists today, with some extra decoration, was founded. And that's when it started adopting laws for the polity that was then known as the Union of South Africa. And since then, 317 racial acts of parliament have been adopted in total. Of those, 142 are still on the books. About 9 of them have been deracialized, so 133 of them are still racial and applicable. And I think the most shocking number really is that of the 317, 117 were adopted since 1994. So that's 37% of the total. And of course, we've heard the stories that real discrimination ended in 1994, and that was replaced with redress laws. And this is now to set right the discrimination of the past. And as far as kind of I'm concerned, and the index is concerned, is that that's fine. You can make that argument in favor of these laws, but they are still race laws. And that's the kind of the thing that people like Tudi Maroncela and some journalists, Pierre de Vos and so on, keep getting caught up on. It's essentially to say that, well, after 94, we had good vibes race law, and therefore it does not qualify as race law. And I think that is an approach that is going to necessarily cause confusion, especially amongst foreigners. How you describe the intentions of a specific piece of race law is entirely in your hands and your kind of subjective estimation of whether it's good or bad. What we want to do is show the world, tell the world that the phenomenon of race in law, i.e., someone's skin color being recognized as a legally relevant factor is still alive and well in South Africa. And you might like that. We don't. And that's an important piece of information to share with the world and with those South Africans who aren't quite clued up on how deep this stuff really goes.
What do you mean by good vibes laws?
Yeah, so there's a prevailing notion that, and I was surprised really by this a while back. I had assumed that people generally bought into this idea that you cannot judge a law or a policy by its intentions. I mean, the famous quote, "The road to hell is paved with good intentions." I thought people instinctively understood that, but I was wrong. A lot of people who support the redress laws of post-apartheid South Africa would say that they are unlike the race laws that came before 1994, not for any kind of quantifiable or qualifiable reason of look at how much benefit it has brought the country, but really and seriously just based on the intention with which it was ostensibly adopted, and that is to repair damage. So it is an exclusive look at how this thing has been dressed up, how it has been sold to the public, and that is to say that it is there to help people. Now, the same happened during apartheid, and that's what frustrates me so much. When the Group Areas Act was introduced, it was said that this would protect the racial groups from dominating each other, and when the Natives Land Act was adopted, the absurd claim was made that it is going to protect Black South African land from being bought by rich white developers, and this is why they had to have... I mean, obviously the people who introduce laws are going to try and justify them based on good intentions and good vibes and good feelings and so on, and that's never going to change. And if we as a vigilant public, as policy analysts and certainly as journalists, geez, if we are going to judge these laws based only on the kind of feelings and the justifications made by the politicians for them, we're actually never going to get to the bottom of it. And that's why kind of the better approach is to judge these things by their consequences. And the index does not look at their consequences specifically because we want to maintain objectivity here. But you judge them by their consequences and you judge them by their very nature. And my personal view is that when it comes to race law, you must judge it simply on its nature. And that is, the common law knows no race. There are men and women in common law. There are adults and children in common law, but there are no blacks and whites in common law. So if you want the law to see race as relevant, you have to introduce legislation or a regulation or something. And in my view, that is the wrong approach. You shouldn't make people's race relevant at law because they simply cannot control what race they are born as.
I guess it's also broad strokes. There are the children of very, very wealthy people who are black or Indian or colored. Now, I'm using the old Population Registration Act, which, as you pointed out, was terminated in the 1990s. But there could be very wealthy people coming from those backgrounds who have an easy entree into the best schools and into universities. And on the other hand, you have people from the white group who have absolutely no chance of ever thinking of getting to university because they just don't have the wherewithal. So it's a broad brush that is painted here, which surely is not the intention, even if you do think it is good vibes. Or how is that argument answered?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that the Institute of Race Relations specifically has made many arguments on, and it's quite simple. If you want to kind of repair the disadvantages of the past, you have to look at disadvantage. You have to look at socioeconomic disadvantage, and that's a perfectly observable and quantifiable phenomenon. You ask people for their income statements, whatever. You can get that information. But the government, I think, or the political class in South Africa has, for rightly or wrongly, determined that race is kind of a currency in our politics, and that if you justify things based on race, that kind of activates people in some way, and it seems to be just easier to take that route rather than to do the hard work of determining advantage, disadvantage. And of course, then there's the corruption element. I'm not sure how far this factors into these the process of adopting these laws, but But obviously, when you have to consider someone's race, that makes it very easy for some politically connected person to kind of weasel their way into a deal because they have no other qualifying aspects other than their race. And that's how BEE to some degree has been kind of used as a mechanism for corruption. So all these things probably play into that. The academic justification just shortly before the end of apartheid was that, well, it's difficult to end poverty. So the kind of midway step between kind of now and when we eventually end poverty is to create this class of black economic elites, and the black masses would kind of almost live vicariously through them and see that, oh, good, Tokyo Sequale is doing very well and these businessmen are doing very well. They're black, I'm black, and therefore there's a symbolic value in creating this black elite, and that in itself is somehow valuable. Now, I think that's a problematic way to approach the question of solving poverty. I think the poverty has been solved all around the world. There are very kind of simple solutions to this issue. You kind of free the market. The World Bank just told us almost word for word exactly how we must start approaching this issue, make it easier to employ people. This is not rocket science, but yet we're trying to apply this formula based proportionality. You mentioned the land audit earlier, kind of. If you are 7% of the population, you only get to own 7% of the land, and so on. And that's kind of the logic that the race laws after 1994 and before 1994, to be frank, are based on. And yeah, it's just important that people know this, because there's been talk about race law in South Africa for many, many years, and it's never really been quantified. And now that this work has been done, it's causing contention and controversy, and that's good. But finally, now there is a resource for people to rely on to actually do the additional work.
Martin, those who are benefiting from the system as it is currently structured are going to be fighting tooth and nail to retain it. But those who are disadvantaged by the system as it's currently structured are clearly doing what they can. And is this behind, to a degree, what we're seeing with the reaching out to someone like Donald Trump, who you've got to wonder what he's got to do with South African affairs, but it does appear as though increasingly he's now playing a role and being introduced into this country to play a role here.
Yeah. No, thank goodness. I'm not the man's biggest fan by any stretch of the imagination, but we have had a situation in South Africa for decades now where pointing these issues out to the state has been met by really a cold shoulder. The government has had contempt for any insinuation that a race-based approach must be replaced. If you want to have government kind of assistance with a non-racial approach, the government has rejected this outright. And the going over into the GNU, which caused a lot of kind of excitement last year, in May of last year, that has not in any way, shape, or form changed this approach. From race-based to disadvantage-based. So there's been litigation over the years. The Constitutional Court has heard many cases on race law, and ultimately that court has accepted the logic of the kind of the state on we need to use race. So what are South Africans to do next? You cannot just accept race law as a phenomenon. This didn't happen during apartheid. This didn't happen during Jim Crow and the American South. So what were we to do? I think the obvious answer was you need to try and muster international and foreign pressure on the South African government to change its ways. And I think it's really excellent that the world superpower has taken an interest in what's happening in South Africa. It might cause some short-term damage, but it has made the environment more fluid. And I think that is a good thing, because we've been set in our ways of legislating by race for far too long. And maybe now there's a chance to actually turn that around.
Well, it's interesting that the World Bank you mentioned earlier is also banging this drum. But for anybody who has a vaguest understanding of economics, it's obvious who's going to invest if you have a 30% tax on anything that you invest with. which is essentially what BEE is. So from that perspective, it's kind of a no-brainer, but there's a big kickback. There's a lot of antibodies that are kicking back against this, and it almost feels, in part anyway, that the argument is being hijacked into one of do not interfere in our affairs. We know what we need to do to redress the past, and attitudes seem to be hardening.
Yeah, I mean, this was very much expected. I mean, you saw this during the previous dispensation as well. Everyone said that, listen, we South Africans know best how to solve our racial questions, so the world must stay uninvolved. And the ANC was at the very forefront of rejecting that logic. It went all around the world to the communist bloc, to the Western bloc, and said we need help to fight the system of racial engineering that's being imposed on peaceful and innocent people. That kind of calculation has not changed. Just because kind of some of the details in the race law have changed does not wipe away the fact that people's circumstances of their birth are being weaponized against them in this country. And people say, well, the white minority is wealthy and so on. And that's, we cannot dispute that. Of course, white South Africans as a group relatively do better than black South Africans. And AfriForum and Solidarity are not saying that white people are this poor kind of minority that is suffering and languishing. The victim mentality has never kind of found purchase amongst those civic groups. So that's not what's being said. What's being said is that this minority, whether wealthy or poor, is being discriminated against on the basis of its race. Various other racial groups are also not on the benefiting side of this. And of course, the black majority does not benefit from the ostensible kind of benefits that these laws are aimed at achieving for them. So the equation of getting foreign pressure to bear on your government has not changed. There's nothing wrong with it. It's part of kind of a healthy democracy to be able to bring any pressure to bear on the state. And I mean, the latest news that charges of treason have been laid against AfriForum and Solidarity is shocking. And I think if the GNU wants to show that it's actually a good faith government, it must immediately reject those charges that are being laid by MK and some others and say that we will not interfere with the democratic right of organizations and individuals to challenge what the government of the day has adopted. And to just say that, well, you have to go through the courts and write a petition to parliament, you cannot determine the grounds of disagreement. Ultimately, if you as the government do not want to listen to submissions to parliament or so on, to nice letters, then some pressure has to be brought to bear on you. And we know that the ANC responds to foreign pressure above many, many other forms of pressure. So this is an entirely valid thing to do. And I think AfriForum and Solidarity are certainly doing so out of a sense of patriotism rather than out of a sense of hurting South Africa.
The other argument against your index is that a lot of these laws really don't mean anything anyway.
That's an argument that people can make if they want. So most of the post-94 race laws are so-called representativity laws. So if there's a new board like the National Weather Board or the Board of the National Weather Service being established, there would be a provision that says that the board must be reflective of the racial demographics of South Africa. So most of the race laws in that index are of that nature. But I wouldn't say that that doesn't mean anything. I think it means a great deal. Of course, I wouldn't say that contemporary race laws are more economically harmful than apartheid race laws. Neither does the index claim that. But as far as them being race laws, that is simply true. And it is a distinct phenomenon in law. So as I said earlier, there is no common law of race. So this is a contrivance in our legal and political system. And I think that if you do the additional research of comparing South Africa with the rest of the world, you would probably find, and I don't have evidence for this, but you'll probably find that we do have the most race laws at a kind of parliamentary level. I think that we're one of the few countries that are kind of holding on to this idea that you can racially engineer kind of yourself into prosperity. And that's something worth pointing out. I think it's something that you have to quantify. The arguments that we had a decade ago about Helen Zille tweeting that there are more race laws today than under apartheid, and people saying, oh, no, you're wrong. It's like, well, You just have to count. This is not rocket science. You just literally have to go and do the work. And now it's been done. And I think we've taken a step into a better understanding of the race dispensation in South Africa. And there's obviously more research to be done. The index is never going to be complete. It's always going to be a work in progress as more information becomes available and as the user experience is refined. But I think it cannot really be disputed that something, a resource of this nature, is necessary for a country like South Africa, especially of its history and its current preoccupation of race.
Well, it was interesting reading again through your background that the Institute for Race Relations published the first survey of these race laws in 1936, and then again in 1949 after the apartheid government took over in 1948. But just to close off with, you did mention internationally. It occurred to me the article that has so angered Donald Trump that was published under Cyril Ramaphosa's byline in Foreign Policy magazine in Washington last week was co-authored by the Prime Minister of Malaysia, which is another country that has race laws. So maybe the idealistic positioning on both of these individuals, if not both of those countries, is aligned.
Yeah, no, I mean, Malaysia, India, and South Africa, I think, are maybe three notable kind of exceptions in the world of countries that still have a kind of a dispensation of race law. So, yeah, there's definitely an alignment there. And I think the other irony is also that the ANC and Cyril Ramaphosa are very kind of happy to utilize foreign pressure to, for instance, try and pressure the Israeli government into changing its ways. And that's what that foreign policy article was ultimately about. And yet they would have the temerity to at the same time criticize organizations like AfriForum and Solidarity using kind of just the power of persuasion rather than actually going to the International Criminal Court to try and persuade people to take certain action. So there's a lot of perversity involved here. And if Ramaphosa is allowed to rely on his allies, Malaysia, then surely South Africans who care about non-racialism, about a growing economy, and about kind of a sensible, healthy society are also allowed to go to their friends around the world, not just in America, but certainly in other places as well, to try and muster some pressure.
You've done a lot of research. That is by nature what you do. When one looks back, you can get an understanding perhaps of where we might be going forward. And have you got any thoughts on how this might all end up, where it might go to from here?
Yeah, it's a very fluid political environment now. I think with the 2024 election so kind of recent in our memories, I think a lot of us hoped and thought that this would be the beginning of real big change. The ANC has been remarkably good at ensuring that that is not the case. And the other parties have been remarkably bad at trying to change the ANC in that respect. So, things are highly fluid. I'm not sure that we're going to have a political solution to this, at least during this parliamentary term until 2029. But now I think that it's clear that the kind of mystique around the ANC internationally has been broken to a large degree. And that means we're starting with Donald Trump now, but I think in the coming years, you're going to see world leaders having a looser tongue maybe on what's going on in South Africa and speaking about it. And that does kind of strengthen our arm in South Africa as well to use that to buttress our arguments. In the meantime, of course, the state proofing journey continues. Communities are stepping into where there is collapse. They're not waiting for the government to come and rescue them. So that will just continue. The form of the equation has not changed meaningfully since the election of last year. And we'll try again in 2029 to see if some formal political change can be brought. I know there will be litigation. I don't have a lot of faith in our courts, unfortunately, to really make a substantive difference to how South Africa is governed. But I do think that the international pressure is going to play a bigger role now than it has in the last 30 years of democracy. And I think that is exciting. I think we need to be careful. But I do think there is some reason to think that potentially, if there's a pragmatic streak left in the ANC, you might see some of these race laws being being undone over the next few years. We've already seen that happen a few years ago at the ILO with Solidarity, when they took affirmative action against with Tulas Mkhize to the ILO. The ANC accepted the notion that there must be a sunset clause on racial affirmative action. They haven't done anything. They've broken that agreement. So of course we knew that was coming, but they at least accepted nominally the premise that these things must come to an end at some stage. And that's, I think that's significant. So I think, a fluid environment, and over the next few years, we're going to see a government that's probably going to be more open to accepting these criticisms. We know the ANC operates on a balance of forces kind of analysis, and it seems like that balance is turning against it internationally, which is really something the ANC has always taken very, very seriously.
Martin van Staden is the head of policy at the Free Market Foundation, and he also is the editor and compiler of the Race Law Index. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.